This call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 5:06 p.m. on Tuesday, April 12th, 2016. Present today, we have Representative Wilson, Representative Guerra, Vice Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Newman, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Gaddis, Representative Edgemond. And with that, we'll get started. Please turn off your cell phones. No electronic devices allowed in committee. On today's schedule, we have House Bill 245, Permanent Fund, Deposits, Dividends, Earnings, by House Rules by request of the Governor. We're going to hear House Bill 245, and we have a CS version E. Rep. Newman, we have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move committee substitute for House Bill number 245, Finance version 29-GH2859/E, ECHO, before the committee for discussion purposes and a vehicle for discussion.
Are there any objections? We will be addressing the CS version. Ms. Pearson, would you please come to the table, put yourself on the record, and go through this sectional for the CS?
I'm crushed. I thought we were hearing my oil tax bill.
It's close.
For the record, my name's Jane Pearson, staff to Representative Steve Thompson, and I'd like to run you through the sectional for the CS for House Bill 245 Finance. Section 1 provides for a three-year reevaluation of the use of the earnings of the Alaska Permanent Fund. Section 2, Amaretta Hess income is no longer flows to the Capital Income Fund. Segregation of Amaretta Hess is no longer legally required, and associated language is repealed in Section 13. Section 3, dedicated deposit of royalties to the Permanent Fund are reduced from the current 25-50 split in old-new leases to the constitutional minimum of 25%. Section 4, subsection A, requires that the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to determine the net income of the earnings reserve account as income is realized and received. Subsection B defines the percent of market value payout as 5.25% of the average year-end market value of the permanent fund and earnings reserve account for the first five and most recently completed six fiscal years. The payout may not exceed the year-end balance of the earnings reserve account for the fiscal year just ended. Section 5, AS 3713-145, is the disposition of income to the permanent fund statute. Subsection A is unchanged. It establishes the ERA and identifies the ERA as holding earnings of the permanent fund and an earnings reserve account. Subsection B is repealed, dividends based on statutory net income. Subsection C is repealed. It's inflation proofing. Subsection D is repealed, segregation of Amaretta Hess. Subsection E is new. The legislature may annually appropriate to the PMOV payout from the ERA to the general fund. Section 6, dividends are comprised of 20% of the 5.25 PMOV outline in Section 4B and 20% of the prior year's royalties, excluding those dedicated to the permanent fund or school fund. 25.5% are dedicated. Section 7, the Mental Health Trust Fund may not be included in the computation of the available income for distribution under the PMOV. Section 8 makes computation of the Mental Health Trust Fund income consistent with the computation of other permanent fund income. Section 9, transfer money to the dividend requires an appropriation. Section 10, the amount of each permanent fund dividend for the fiscal year 2017, 18, and 19 shall be $1,000. Section 11 conforms to Section 9, which moves money to the dividend fund by appropriation. Section 12, once money is in the dividend fund, the Department of Revenue shall annually pay dividends without any further appropriation. Section 13 repeals language relating to the former dividend calculation, inflation proofing, calculation, and the Amaretta Hess language. Section 14 repeal Section 10, the $1,000 dividend in the first 3 years. Section 15, the Commissioner of Revenue and the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation may adopt regulations, policies, and procedures to implement this act. Section 16 is a retroactivity clause. Section 17, immediate effective date for Section 15 and 16. Section 18 is the effective date of July 1st, 2016.
Thank you, Ms. Pearson. Representative Guttenberg?
I'm missing page 6 from the job.
That deletes the funding for the Fairbanks Natural Gas Project.
Here it comes. We'll do a brief at ease. We're back on the record. Everybody now has page 6 of the bill. Thank you, Representative Guttenberg, for noticing that. Here today to introduce the bill to the committee is David Teal, our legislative fiscal analyst. Mr. Teal, please come forward, place yourself on the record, and walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And I'm not sure exactly what you'd like. You want me to just walk through these charts?
That would be fine to start there if you'd like.
Okay. The first chart is the status quo or business as usual situation. What you should notice about it is that the reserves are shown in the lower left-hand corner. And those reserves are vanishing after FY21, which then brings you up to the chart in the upper left-hand corner, which shows expenditures as the line, and then revenue as the bars. Blue is the oil or the normal forecast, in non-oil and oil combined. The orange bars are draws from the CBR that are used to fill the deficit, and the red bar indicates that you're beginning to use money from the earnings reserve to fill that deficit. It clearly shows a lot of white space over to the right after 22. That's because once your reserves are gone in FY22, the model, the economy, whatever you want to call it, is broken, and you can't function this way. So all the other charts don't mean much, because what that means is you cannot maintain the level of expenditure shown on the chart. You'd have to cut your level of expenditures down to your revenue bars in order to continue to function budgetarily. So it does show that dividends continue, and of course they could not continue when you have the white space there.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah, just for clarification on all these charts, David, so like let's say the bottom right-hand corner where mm-hmm. it says FY16, are these at the end after FY16 or during FY16? Just for all these.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, they're all year-end balances.
So the FY16 is a year-end balance. Okay, got it.
Continue, David.
Okay, so the purpose of number one was just to emphasize again that we have a problem, and the problem is that you do not have sufficient revenue to fund your anticipated level of expenditures. So the bill is an attempt to address that problem and solve some but not all of the problem. So chart number two is a model of this bill, and you'll notice that right about in the middle it says House Resources, but I'll just start from the top and walk through the information that's presented between the graphs. This is true of all the graphs. They're using spring forecast. The operating budget growth is held at zero growth, and there's a cut there of $247 million, which is just an approximation of where the conference, where the House and Senate are now with the operating bills, the capital bill that's been submitted, retirement adjustments to actuarial things, so that it's an approximation. It doesn't really change much of what you're doing. Community assistance is assumed to be $30 million per year, and the capital budget in the out years is $185 million. You can pretty much skip down to the information in the right above the blue bar where it says permanent fund variables. We're using 6.9% as an investment return. Yeah. So 6.9% investment return, and then in the blue, you'll see the POMV payout is 5.25%, and the dividends, as Jane Pearson noted, are 20% of the payout. That 5.25% payout goes to dividends, as does 20% of prior year royalties. The dividend has a floor of $1,000. It's actually, they will be set at $1,000 for FY17, 18, and 19. And then the variable that we're looking at here was in the middle under revenue variables, and the tax credit reform is set for this run at House Resource version. So the numbers that you may want to look at are lower left. Your reserve balance is $10.4 billion. Your deficit is $624, and your reserve should last 17 years at that burn rate. If you have a deficit of $600, just divided into the 10 years, and it'll give you $10 billion reserves. You'll have 17 years at that level of expenditures. The table on the lower right shows you whether the permanent fund is keeping pace with inflation, and you can see that by 2025, the permanent fund is falling slightly behind. It's at 97% of real value, and right below that is effective payout. It's about 4.9%. So there, well, the nominal payout was 5.25%. Because it's looking back 6 years, and the balance of the permanent fund is increasing, the effective payout, by that I mean this year's payout based on the current balance, is actually under 5%. The only difference between chart 2 and 3 is that it uses house finance for tax credit reforms. And you can see that dividends don't change any. The permanent fund changes very little. The only part you'll notice is on the lower left, where reserves have gone from $10.4 billion under the House Resources version of tax credits to now $11.9. So I think some people might conclude that the House Resources version over this time period means you'll end up with about $1.5 billion less reserves than if you adopted the House Finance version. Chart 4 is the same, except for a difference on investment return. Here it assumes a 7.45% return, long-term investments, and that's consistent with the Callan Associates memo. They advise the permanent fund, and their December 24th memo says that 7.45% is the, I'll just quote their letter if that's okay. The most salient impacts of the revision are a reduction in the median projected 10-year annualized total return from 7.8 to 7.45. So using 7.45%, everything else the same as the chart number 3, the primary difference is that your reserves will last longer because you're earning more money on both your on your permanent fund and the earnings reserve. And you can see in the table in the lower right that the real value of the permanent fund is now more than keeping pace with inflation. It's 102% of the real value.
All right. I'm sure people are looking this over and going to have some questions. I just wanted you to explain one thing. In the center column on the very bottom, it shows CBR earnings is 6%. Can you explain that to the committee, please?
Mr. Chairman, the CBR is currently earning 1% to 2%, and it's a point that the governor raised in his plan. His solution was to move the CBR into the earnings reserve account. There are other solutions, as we mentioned earlier in talking about this bill. It's not necessary to physically combine those accounts. All you need to do is invest the CBR more aggressively. Whether the permanent fund or the Department of Revenue does that wouldn't matter, but we're assuming that there will be discussions about the ability to invest the CBR more aggressively if the draws on it are substantially lower than they are today. And it's an assumption. We don't know. 6%, 5%, it doesn't significantly change the model output.
It would be definitely a lot more than the 1-point-some-odd percent that we're making at the present time on the CBR, correct?
Mr. Chairman, if you have $7 billion in an account and earn 1% on it versus 6%, that's $350 million a year difference. So it's something that the committee may wish to follow up on and try to change those investment parameters.
We have other questions. Vice Chair Newman.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Newman, excuse me.
An upgrade.
Yeah, upgrade.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Mr. Teal. If we look at the top left UGF revenue budget in millions chart, where we're at right now, chart four, I notice that you're starting the budget at a little below $5 billion. So if we were to bring that down to 4.5 or 4.4, does that make any significant changes in the length of the amount of money that would stay in reserves?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it does, and I should point out here that you'll notice the increase from 16 to 17. That's a different way of counting. In 16, permanent fund dividends were not counted. If you counted them, that $5 billion expenditure would be $6.4 billion. So 17 is actually a reduction from 16. The same question came up in the Senate Finance Committee, and they suggested that we add a line to the chart showing what expenditures would be without dividends, as which is the normal way we think about it now. That would reduce that line by $700 million a year or so. But directly answering your question, anytime you shift the expenditure line downward, you're reducing the gap, which is shown here in the little orange bars, draws from the CBR. It would reduce or eliminate that draw, which would then, with a balanced budget, you would have no draw on reserves, and your reserves would be healthier than shown.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed on the fiscal note it relies on a payout of a little over a $2,000 dividend in the fiscal note document. So again, going down to $1,000, that would be about a $700 million impact. So even if we say we reduce the budget another $300 million, I'm just putting stuff out there for numbers. So basically $1 billion less than what you're showing in that budget number now. Does that have high significance in how the numbers would change and with that much money, again, and related to the top left chart?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it does. You can see in the table at the lower left that the deficit in the out years is, I'll call it $350 million. So the number that you chose comes pretty close to eliminating that deficit entirely, at which point your reserves would just grow instead of being burned. So, yes, $350 million a year makes a big difference. That's if that occurs every year, and we've got a roughly, a 10-year outlook here, 8-year outlook, you're looking at $2 billion impact over that time. So it moves the lines quite a bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Again, let's look at that number four, revenue variables. You have included zero taxes in this. Is that correct? There's no sales tax, income tax, motor fuel tax. There's no taxes included?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
So if we do institute something along these lines, it is going to lengthen out and increase the savings?
Mr. Chairman, as far as the model is concerned, there's no difference between reducing expenditures or increasing taxes. Both of them close the deficit. As your deficit is reduced, you burn less reserves. So there are no taxes here. Any taxes that you imposed would make this picture look better.
Thank you, Vice Chair Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teal, I want to ask you questions about the effect of inflation on the models here. You're assuming 2.25% inflation, okay? And in Section 6 of the bill, we talk about the dividends being comprised of a fifth of the POMV stream and a fifth of the prior year's royalties. I understand the theory that says the inflation proofing is built into the permanent fund corpus with a percent of market value, but is to what degree is the permanent fund dividend after the first 3 years guarantee protected against the erosion of inflation?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as the permanent fund, including the earnings reserve balance, grow, the payout grows. As the payout grows, a constant percentage of that payout goes to dividends, so the dividends are protected from inflation just as the full payout is, just as the permanent fund is.
Representative Sadler.
Okay, I can see that for the element that's drawn from the POMV stream, but what about the royalties? I'm not seeing how royalties is covered as well.
Again, through the chair, to the extent that oil prices reflect inflation, the royalties would also be inflation-proof. However, as production declines, or if production declines, then royalties could decline for that reason. So royalties don't have the same protection, necessarily have the same protection against inflation.
Okay, interesting. Okay, what was my other question? Thank you. For everyone's assistance, looking down the middle column, there's just a couple terms I want to clarify. In the kind of the bottom third, we have percent realized under permanent fund values. What does that mean?
Through the chair, realized earnings go to the earnings reserve account. Unrealized earnings affect market value, but they're not part of what can actually be paid out. It's not cash until it's realized. So that as we run this model, we do differentiate between the permanent fund total investment rate, which is 7.45% in this run, and then only 75-76% of that is realized. The rest of it is unrealized and does increase your market value, but not your cash in hand.
Gotcha. So it's 76% of that 7.45%. Gotcha. Okay. Okay. That's it for now. I'll come back.
Thanks. Further questions? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, David. A couple of technical questions. You're assuming part of this plan is predicated on earning more money on interest from the Constitutional Budget Reserve. And but every year, even though this plan uses less of the Constitutional Budget Reserve, some will have to be spent. And so have you spoken to the permanent fund managers about whether they would invest it aggressively, knowing that some has to be spent every year? That's the question. Obviously, they don't invest it very aggressively right now because they know it's disappearing really quickly. And if under this plan, it would disappear more slowly. So that 6% figure, is that something the permanent fund feels comfortable with, or is that something that we're assuming they feel comfortable with?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we have not talked. I think we will be talking to the Commissioner of Revenue and or the permanent fund people. Right now, the CBR is managed by the Department of Revenue, and they have rules about when the CBR is being drawn upon. They will invest it in more liquid assets, and we're just trying to find a way to get more, to get a higher return on that money. I think it's the same thing the governor faced, so I believe the governor and the commissioner have discussed this, and we just need to make sure that the rate is viable. As I said, 5% versus 6% doesn't really make a whole lot of difference. 1% versus 6% does. But I I think we will be discussing that with them in the next few days.
Also tonight, today, we do have Commissioner Hoff back here, and I believe we have somebody from the Attorney General's office here also.
Yeah, the Attorney General.
Is he here? There he is. we have Attorney General Richards here also. He was hiding back there. Representative Garrett, continue.
Yeah, a few more technical questions. And is there, in this bill, is there a statutory change that allows the Constitutional Budget Reserve funds to be managed by the Permanent Fund, or is that needed?
Through the chair, there is no provision like that. There could be, but I'm not sure it makes a lot of difference whether the money is invested by the Permanent Fund or the Department of Revenue. The issue is investment parameters or allocation of your investments, not who's managing it.
And just one final technical question through the chair. Thank you. So on all of the bottom right-hand corner charts, let's use the one on the last page.
Page 4?
Yeah. In the key, there's the status quo, governor's plan, custom plan, SB 114, and HB 224, all in different colors. But in the bars, there's only two colors. So I'm just trying to understand what that is.
Through the chair, that chart gets so busy if you try to put every option on there that we suppressed them, put only the status quo and then the option which has a yes value. So if you look in the middle, your choices are the governor's plan or SB 114 / House Bill 303 or Representative Hawker's Bill 224 or custom. It will show the status quo and the one that you have selected rather than showing all of them that you're not focusing on.
Representative Garrett.
So the one that is, so it's right now it's the status quo compared to the version in the bill, which I guess is the custom plan.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Through the chair, that's correct. And you'll notice the same thing in the dividend. It has a number of things in the legend, but only two lines.
And then I guess I do have one other question, Mr.
Representative Garrett.
Yeah. So a while ago, you've shown this model or your various versions of the model many, many times, and I appreciate all the work. But it didn't really seem, I mean, if you're somebody who believes, you know, there are folks around the table who are more oil revenue people. There are folks around the table who are revenue from another source people, right? But leaving aside whether you raised any of those revenues, it didn't seem like changing the dividend amount did anything to like really exhaust savings in 10 years. So if you had a dividend of not $1,000 like this plan proposes, but like $1,500, would you still have savings after 10 years? Do you know?
Through the chair, you would still have savings. You can look at it this way. $1,000 dividend is costing roughly $700 million per year. So if you wanted to raise that by 50%, it would cost you, call it $300 million per year. And that's going to build because when you spend money on dividends, it's just like spending it on anything else. So it the model simply looks at it as that's $300 million more that you've spent, and therefore $300 million less reserves available. So yes, at that, if you had a $1,500 cap on dividend, just roughly, it would reduce your reserve balance by about $2.5 billion by 25.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One technical question, then the larger question. I'm noticing on the charts in the middle toward the top under cost variables,
Each of the charts has a target cut of $247 million. Is that year upon year, or is that in 1 year? Help me understand that, please.
Through the chair, that assumes a $247 million cut in 17, and then maintaining that level through the out years. It's not a 247 on top of the 247, and then another one. It is.
Through the chair, it's a bit of an odd number. Just for by guessing, by gosh, 250 would have been different. Why? How did you get 247?
Through the chair, you could change it if you want. No, it, I.
How about a billion?
It's that number is simply a calculation based on the changes that were made in the operating and capital budgets in the House and Senate. So you're probably right. We should have just put in minus 250.
And my policy question, please, through the chair, remind those of us for whom Admiralty Hess is kind of historical, what the implications of that, how much money is there, how is that accomplished, and what's the effect, how important a piece does that play in this?
Admiralty Hess is a fenced-off portion of the permanent fund. It's about $425 million. And the way that used to work was that, well, the legal case on it is that it, the money earned on it could not be used to pay dividends. So instead, those earnings of roughly $21 million per year were deposited into the capital income fund and typically spent on in the capital budget. The money now won't be fenced off anymore. That extra $21 million of earnings just becomes part of the percent of market value payout.
So, is, through the chair, so the implication is that that money has been available by a statutory change ever since it was established, I think it was late 70s, early 80s? Or?
Through the chair, that's correct. It except that it hadn't been available until probably 5 years ago. We continued to inflation-proof the Amaret Hess portion of the thing, and the value of that fenced-off portion continued to grow. We stopped inflation-proofing it, I guess, about 5 years ago, and began using the earnings in the capital budget. So the net effect of deleting the Amaret Hess is zero. You've been spending that money. You'll now continue to spend that money. It's just going to be not identified as Amaretta Hess because the legal reasons for that separation or segregation no longer exist.
Thank you.
And Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm guilty of probably staring at these charts, not listening closely enough, but I'm just wondering if you might be able to walk us through again page number 2, which is the House Resource Tax Credit Reform version, and page 3, which is the House Finance Tax Credit Reform version. They're both at 6.9% interest rate, earning a rate of return for a permanent fund. And what I'm seeing, just looking at the numbers here, is that the reserves in the House Finance version in FY25, and I'm perhaps getting ahead of you here a little bit, but again, this is slide number 3. The reserves in FY25 are $11.9 billion versus the House Resources Tax Credit version. FY25 is $10.4 billion. And that's a pretty significant difference, $1.5 billion. But the graphs themselves don't look a whole lot different, just from face value, at least in the lower left-hand corner. There is some difference, but maybe give you an opportunity to kind of explain the differences between those two versions.
Through the chair, I think you pretty accurately described the difference, and you're right. If you were handed one of these pieces of paper and then another one a minute later, you'd probably say it looks the same to me. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the problem with modeling these numbers, is that you can lose $500 million in these graphs very easily. And, you know, you can look at them and say, well, under the House Finance version of tax credit reform, your reserves are $12 billion, and under the House Resources version, they're just over 10.4. So you hit the comparison right on the head.
Right. I think if I might, through the chair, I think what...
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, I think what this modeling does illustrate is that what might appear in 1 year's time to be a nominal sum, like let's say $300 to $400 million over a multi-year period, actually grows into a considerable amount of money when you model it out into the future. And so I think that catches my attention. If I might, and again, I'm guilty probably not listening closely enough, but in Section 14 of the bill, the dividend is repealed in June 30th of 2020. What did I miss there?
Through the chair, what you missed was the $1,000 fixed dividend was repealed at 21, and it becomes the dividend as calculated by the formula, which turns out to be just about $1,000 anyway. In fact, if you didn't do the $1,000 fixed, those 17, 18, and 19 dividends would be approximately $900 and going up towards the $1,000 in a fairly smooth curve.
Okay.
I wanted to point out to you, too, Representative Edgman, is that the blue bar on the bottom left of each of those shows how many years of reserves are left. Mm-hmm. With the House Finance version, there's 28 years. We're using the House Resources version, there is 17 years of reserves.
Okay.
Continue, Representative.
Yeah, and just a follow-up question. The middle column, there's an inflation rate at 2.25%. But did we in the bill eliminate inflation proofing?
Through the chair, it eliminates inflation proofing as outlined in statute, or actually specified in statute is a better word. And the inflation proofing takes place because you're assuming that you're going to earn 6.9 or 7.4 or whatever, but it's greater than your payout, which is 5.25. So anything above your 5.25 that isn't paid out serves as inflation proofing.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg? No, thank you. Oh, I thought your antenna. Your microphone pointed towards you there. Representative Guerra?
Mr. Chair, there does seem to be a big difference depending on which version of the oil tax credit bill you adopt. So I know you don't have your interactive model with you, but if we cut the deficit by the amount estimated by the governor's original bill, do you have any estimates as to how long savings would last and what they would look like on these bars? Or the differences, I know in the out years were about $250 million a year.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't remember that number, but the governor's proposal had significant fiscal impacts. And in fact, what happens is the reserve line turns upward under the governor's proposal instead of being flat or continuing to go down slowly. But I don't remember the exact number of years. What I can say is that number of years is just a mathematical calculation. There's no guarantee here that it's going to be, 17 years or 28 years. It just, I think, helps give you some perspective on the reserves.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, the Chair. I understand these are estimates, but are you saying that, so let's look, I guess, at the last page, bottom left-hand corner is the reserves, which decrease in all of these years. Are you saying the amount of reserves actually grow if we did the generated the revenue and tax credit reductions in the governor's version of the bill, it would actually rise the reserves?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made mention about the real versus nominal. Can I assume that because we have 2.25% inflation, that all the figures here are, in fact, real numbers on all the charts?
Through the chair, they are not. They are all nominal.
Okay.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Help me, as I'm looking at this, trying to analyze it, it's quite attractive in a lot of ways. I'm wondering where the magic comes from. Where does the money come from? So correct me if I'm wrong. The money comes out of this plan to fill the deficit almost all the way and to extend the CBR and the earnings reserve. I think it's from less permanent fund paid out, about 2,200 versus 1,000. The interest on a larger permanent fund corpus, that's large because there's less permanent fund drawn. It's the end of statutory inflation proofing and then the 5.25% POMV draw. That's where the money comes from to accomplish the end goal. Is that correct, or is there other mechanisms that I'm missing?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I think that's you've hit them all.
Further questions? Representative Guerra.
It occurred to me a follow-up question on the last one. So if the reserves rise under the amount of revenue and credit reductions under the governor's plan, would that mean that the constitutional budget reserve, our savings account, would that last then also through those 10 years? And would that stay level or would that decline?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the CBR would stay with a positive balance because you would be eliminating reducing your draws here.
Follow up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If the reserves grow, would it be fair to assume the CBR would remain steady, or would that decrease over that time? I know it's an estimate.
Mr. Chairman, I can put the model live on screen if you want to take a brief at ease, but I can also just answer the question and say the CBR balance does remain higher than shown. The earnings reserve balance would probably go up as well. It's really an issue here of more revenue under the governor's tax credit bill, or less expenditures, however you want to say that, which reduces your deficits, which reduces your draw on reserves. And as you can see here, the CBR is just about gone, which means that in the near future, you would begin drawing from the earnings reserve account. Now, in the House Finance version, I'm looking for page 3. You should be able to just scroll through. Okay, that's House Finance version, and you can see that the CBR remains positive balance through 2025, and your deficits are smaller. In fact, you can just look at number 3 and number 2, the House Resources. The reason for the extended years to exhaust is because in the House resource version, your deficit in 2025 is still over $600 million annually, but it's fallen by $200 million per year under the House finance plan. So smaller deficit means slower reserve burn, which means higher reserve balances. So you're, in the House Finance version, you're simply not using the CBR, and in the governor's version, you're using less of it. Your CBR is going to be about double that value, roughly $4 billion.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is intriguing. This does assume, looking at the, I guess I'll look at the fourth one, it assumes pretty much a flat budget on the upper left-hand corner chart. The black solid line indicates what looks like a pretty flat budget. A lot of other models I've seen looking forward, state budgets include about a 1.5% population and budget growth. I would be curious to see this model to show that kind of increase. I would also like to see what inflation factoring in inflation would do to a lot of these numbers and the dividend. But then I got two questions. Earlier, we had heard that there was a couple different permanent fund models presumed a large deposit from the CBR into the corpus. Does this bill presume any large deposit into the from the CBR?
Through the chair, it does not, but it assumes that the CBR is managed more aggressively, which has approximately the same impact on the model.
And then a question looking at the
Sadler.
Thank you to the chair. Following up on the lower left-hand chart on number four, it looks like the earnings reserve account begins to trend upwards a little bit. Is there any cap on the is there any spillover mechanism whereby if the reserves tip over into a certain threshold, 14 million, 15 million, I don't know, where that money cascades someplace else in the model?
Through the chair, there is not currently a provision like that in the bill. The governor had one that said if your earnings reserve balance is more than four times your draw, that the excess can go back into the corpus of the fund. We left it out on the grounds that the legislature can do anything that it wants with excess earnings reserve balances. You're free to deposit it into the corpus or to the CBR or to simply leave it in the earnings reserve account. We do that because from the model's perspective, not from a political perspective, it doesn't make any difference whether it's in the earnings reserve account or the corpus. Or for that matter, if the earnings rates of return are similar in the CBR, it's all just money sitting in a reserve.
And last one, Mr. Probert.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. And again, you said earlier, Mr. Thiel, that the permanent fund the dividend, because it was predicated both on investment returns and on the price of oil, both of which were reflect inflation proofing. It's flat roughly in all the models here at about $1,000. If you accounted for inflation, I'm going to assume that would decrease at a 2.2% compounded. So that gives me a little bit of pause, but any comment on that? That's not really a question.
Through the chair, that's driven to some extent by population growth. You can see in the lower right that the permanent fund balance has grown or will grow according to these projections. And I'll just go to number four, so we're all talking about the same numbers. The current balance is roughly $54 billion. By 2025, it is $65 billion. So it is maintaining its purchasing power or real value, depending on how you want to think of that. And clearly, the constant 5.25% of an additional $10 million, your payout becomes larger and larger over time. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking at on flat dividends is a combination of growing dividends due to the POMV, declining dividends due to royalties, and declining dividends due to population growth. And the three of those give you essentially a flat line.
What was the first one again? You said growing because?
A growth in the permanent fund balances, and your POMV grows because of that.
Through the chair.
Representative Sadler.
I'm sorry, and are there population growth estimates built into these models, this model?
Through the chair, there are, I think, populations growing at 1.3%.
Do I see that someplace, or?
Not on this.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously, when we model, we're making a lot of assumptions here. One of the assumptions that we're making is right there at the top, price scenario, spring 2016. You know, if spring 2016 is correct, then Saudi Arabia doesn't exist by the time this is there. That's why I don't think that spring 2016 is going to remain that way. So what I don't see in this bill, and that's why I'm asking, correct me if I'm wrong, is something that accounts for, because you just highlighted something, that a larger POMV of 5.25, every year it will be larger as the fund grows. That kind of almost takes into account an inflationary discussion there. But what happens if we're wrong on that? We see a giant spike in funds. What I don't see in here is either a revenue or some sort of cap that prevents us from finding ourselves back in this position, because we have started to spend if the price of oil goes back up. And just like every time it happens in this state, we start spending that cap. When it goes back down, we don't necessarily have that spigot to turn back on in the same capacity. Did I miss something in here? Is there a cap that prevents us from getting into the up and down? That's one of the things I actually agreed with the governor's plan on, was the attempt to try to level it out so we didn't have those ups and down spikes, even if I disagreed with some of the other things. Do we have something that in here that helps us manage that so we're not growing government?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, there's nothing in the bill at this point to do that. It's an easy amendment. You've seen a couple different ways that you can limit expenditures or limit revenue, since they're effectively the same thing. We don't believe any of them work very well, because they're simply rules. And if you follow the rules, great. But you're the legislature, and you don't have to follow the rules. I mean, it comes down to being that simple. So that although you may say you can't spend any more than you spent last year, or you can't spend more than a fixed amount of money, or you can't spend this, the fact of the matter is, if oil were to spike and there were excess revenue available to you, the legislature can spend it. And we don't see a way to put a rule in there that stops you from doing that, while giving you the flexibility to say, yes, but we have a large capital project, gas line, Susitnet, whatever it may be, and gives you the flexibility while still making a strong enough rule. So, but you can certainly put a rule in here. I know the governor has said that's important to him.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe this is something that we can work on, because you just highlighted something that's exactly why people are concerned about the discussion that we're having here, is once we turn on that spigot and start moving money from the permanent fund to pay for government, is that, is because of what you just said, is that we don't follow the rules. And once we turn on that spigot, then it's all over for them. We've now done what they were always concerned about. And so I think that's an important thing to make sure that we have, and maybe we can work on something here, whether it's with the governor's office and yourself, and come up with something. But it's, if we should have a rule, even though the legislature breaks the rules, we should have a rule so that then we're going to force this body and the next body to have to look people in the eye and say, we are going to break our own rules, and we are going to continue. We are going to spend money and hurt. So I'd love to work with you, because I think if we're going to go down this path, that people have been scared of us going down this path. We need to give them some sort of assurance that we, that the legislature will not find ourselves in a position where we have taken this beyond what they're entrusting us to do at this point in time. And so I'd ask for the chairs that to work, and even the rest of the committee here, to I'd like to work on something, and hopefully we can find some support on that, and we'll work with you, Mr. Teal, and maybe the governor's office.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Next, we have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe I missed this. Is there an oil trigger here to where if oil rebounds, that it affects that this goes away, or that it goes more than $1,000, since we are on the spring forecast?
Representative Wilson, there is no oil trigger, but if you're looking at dividends, as oil prices go up, royalties go up. As royalties go up, the dividend goes up. So, and I guess you could say the same thing. Is there a trigger on what Representative Pruitt was referring to, which is if we don't need the revenue from the POMV payout, why make it available to us? And it's a good point that the rule will make you discuss breaking the rule at some point in the future. And that that discussion may be helpful, but remember, the POMV payout is subject to appropriation, which means you don't have to appropriate the whole payout if you don't need it. The question really becomes, how much discretion should the legislature have to spend money that's available to it with or without rules? Because when the governor compares this bill, they assume that if there is a spike, that all the money is spent. We get completely different results because our model assumes that any surplus revenue is saved. So if you see the Department of Revenue run of this with oil movement, you'll see the problem that you're talking about. I think both of you are talking about. Other people argue that what price spike? I mean, we really don't expect one, so should we worry about one? And then there's your argument that, hey, let's have a rule anyway, even if it doesn't apply, because if it applies, we have this. You can craft the bill any way you want it. This is a version. It happens to be the same as the Senate version. They've been going through the same discussions that you have.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
So if I understand you correctly, then the percentages and all that doesn't really matter a whole lot, because all we're really saying in this is that we're going to give you $1,000. I mean, that the floor is $1,000. If we go anything beyond $1,000, that's just, we could, like you said, it's through appropriation. Or is the bill not even saying that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the bill sets the dividend at $1,000 in FY 17, 18, and 19. After that, it's computed by formula. The formula still gives you approximately $1,000. But again, if investment returns are higher than projected here, the dividend would go up. If oil prices are higher than projected, the dividend would go up. So, and in these bars, your revenue here would go up as well. That would make your deficit disappear, which would make your reserves go up. So higher oil prices can only make this look better.
Follow up?
Representative Wilson.
Only if we don't spend it. Because, I mean, there are no spending caps on this at this point. So we could give it as a dividend, but as far as the bill goes, back to appropriation, there would be nothing back to the rural thing that we would have to give more in the dividend through this bill. We could, but there's nothing saying that we have to. We could actually say we couldn't keep the budget down. We're still going to keep spending more, and we choose to put it in the budget versus kind of the formula and the way things work now that it kind of gets, even though it's appropriation now.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the dividend language is designed in a way that says the dividend itself depends on the calculation of the percent of market value payout. So if you decided you didn't want to spend or need to spend the entire POMV payout, your dividend would remain as calculated. It wouldn't fall if you decided we only need half of the POMV this year. So it would go up with prices, with oil prices, but your expenditures would not necessarily. What you spend is your decision. As I said, we modeled it where all the money is saved. Department of Revenue models it as all surplus revenue is spent. What actually happens is, again, up to you, and you can have a rule there that says we're not going to allow ourselves to spend more than 5% above what we spent last year, or firm numbers like the total of POMV plus oil cannot exceed something. There are a number of ways to draft an expenditure or a revenue limit that would work if you followed them.
So final question.
Representative Wilson.
So what I know most of this we can already do back to appropriation. So in the bill, are there things in the bill that we have to do, or could we do most of this if we chose to, just based on our ability to appropriate funds?
Through the chair, I think you could probably do everything via the appropriation process. Certainly most, if not all. The issue there is that it isn't a plan. It isn't a rules-based system. And all this bill is doing is establishing a set of rules. It is not making, it cannot make, the annual appropriations that follow the bill.
But, Mr. Chairman, as you just reminded us, we don't always follow the rules, so I'm not too sure this helps our cause. But thank you.
Thank you. We've got several more people with members with questions, and we are going to set this bill aside at 6:30 so that we can prepare for the House floor session 7. Representative Edgeman, followed by Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's been articulated several times over that this model is dependent on assumptions, and principally among those assumptions, I'm looking at the McKinsey and Company report from last week, is oil production, oil prices, and investment returns. Those are probably the chief assumptions among the many that this model is built on. That said, the one constant in amongst the four different iterations is that there's no other revenue sources from the governor's package, no income taxes, no other taxes incorporated into the bottom line results. How are the bond rating agencies going to view a model like this, going back to those assumptions, assuming that we didn't in our final fiscal package this session incorporate other new revenues such as the governor's proposed in his bill? Would the bond rating agencies, sort of a qualitative question to throw out at you, but would the bond rating agencies, in your opinion, be more apt to look favorably upon Alaska getting its fiscal house in order if we had a more diversified revenue stream, such as other new revenues, or would they look at something like this and say, hey, we think this is a very good first step, and this sort of qualifies as Alaska, the legislature, taking that decisive action that I think a number of those rating agencies have very pointedly told us we needed to take. But what's your sense of all that?
Through the chair, I think you all recognize that you're asking for my opinion here, and I'm happy to give that. I think the bond raters would look at this as a very strong first step. But I agree with you that they might also like to see other revenue sources, which we see as independent of this bill. We see expenditure reductions as independent of this bill. There's nothing in this bill that's going to help you or make you raise revenue or reduce expenditures. It sets up a framework for using the earnings of the permanent fund. That's it. I think the bond raters would say, this is great, and if you pass some revenue measures and cut expenditures further, that would close the gap, and they'd say, that's even better.
Representative Gaddis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, I have a couple questions. And I'll piggyback on some of my colleagues from North Pole and Anchorage. As far as spending limits and revenue, and I guess my bigger question is this. Hopefully when we get to modeling it a little bit more, we get deeper into it. One of the things that strikes me is when we've talked about SB 21 and not going looking at the worst case scenario, well, I don't want to forget to look at the worst case and then the best case scenario when we model this. So I think it's real important that I think I heard you talk about, or we didn't really talk about, if oil goes back up again. I think it's important to look at both sides of that as we model it. I also think even if it's a plan, the plan that has to be adhered to, we have to say that we have a government this size, and part of it is, especially if our model and part of the plan is that the price of oil stays down as low as it does, part of our modeling has to be that government or the size of government goes down. So, and these are my suggestions as we go through. I know you're going to hold the bill and we're going to discuss it further, but I just don't want the committee to forget when I had heard around the table that we hadn't looked at some of those really downside scenarios. So we've got to look at both sides as we go through it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis. Representative Guttenberg, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Teal. We had a presentation here, I think it was last week, it all kind of blurs together, about some consultants to the governor talking about their own assumptions on how things worked and how they didn't. And I asked him, you know, if they tried to crash their assumptions. I don't know if you were here. You know, looking at these graphs, we've got, you know, spending. I mean, everything is pretty stable as the status quo kind of from this point moving forward. You know, whether we spend or not, whether the capital is, you know, the capital budget and all those things are things that are under our control. And thinking about what we can't control. Well, we can't control the price of oil. Obviously, we're here now. But we can't control the economy outside where the market puts that through its own machinations. So have you put the market fluctuations, like a really downside, like 08, into this and see what would happen if the worst-case scenario happened on top of that?
Through the chair, yes, we have, and we can show you some of that when and if we come before the committee with the working model. These are just screenshots from it. They're here to explain the bill as opposed to look at options beyond the bill. So we have a bear start, as you suggested. You can enter different oil prices, enter different rates of return. And as Representative Edgman said, there are just a few big levers.
Yeah.
There are some smaller levers, but the ones you really want to work with are oil prices, rates of return, those sorts of things. Again, your expenditures and your revenue measures are whatever you choose to do, but that's independent of the plumbing here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions from committee at this time? Seeing none, Mr. Teal, thank you very much, and I'm sure we'll be seeing you some more on this bill. At this time, I'm going to set this bill aside, and we'll be starting discussions with it again tomorrow afternoon. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is tomorrow, Wednesday, April 13th, at 8:30 a.m. And at that time, we'll hear House Bill 311, Sustainable Budget Reporting, Senate Bill 170, Department of Natural Resources Fees for Geological, and House Bill 194, Alaska Securities Act Penalties and Certain Rules. And with that, at 6:22 p.m., we are adjourned. Thank you.